Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us, we're at News Talk Science. There are a few tickets left for Get Started with AI, my workshop on how to get to grips with using artificial intelligence to make your life easier. A hugely practical course for anyone who is trying to get stuff done quicker. You can find out details of our Cork show next week on Wednesday and our Galway show the week after at getstartedai.com. Now, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and science broadcaster Phil Smith. You're both very welcome. Ruth, our first story has to be, of course, a nod to the Nobel Prizes, which, unsurprisingly this year, dominated by AI.
They were. If we talk about the big science prizes, both the physics and the chemistry prize really were dominated by AI. But the first one that was announced earlier this week was the Nobel Prize for Medicine. And that went to Victor Ambros, who's in the University of Massachusetts Medical School, and Gary Ruvkin from Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And they were awarded the Nobel Prize together for their discovery of something called microRNAs. And these are tiny little molecules that exist in our genome, and they play a critical role in regulating which of our genes are active at any one time. And that it helps to explain many things that go on in our genes. You know, for example, how some genes cause a cell to differentiate one way and other genes are turned off at the same time. So this is a discovery, as often happens with the Nobel Prizes, that happened many years ago. They made the discovery back in the late 1980s. They were working on this small worm called C. elegans, which is beloved of geneticists because it has a relatively small genome, but it has a lot of similarities to more complex animals. And when they published their findings in 1993, they were initially met with quite a bit of skepticism from the scientific community. But over the years that followed, it became clear that microRNAs weren't just sort of something esoteric in this little worm, but they were in fact conserved throughout complex life. The Nobel Prize for Physics, as you said, very much dominated by AI. It went to John Hopfield of Princeton University and Geoffrey Hinton of the University of Toronto, who previously was in Google, and many people do call him, you know, the father of AI. And they were awarded the prize in physics for their groundbreaking work in developing these artificial neural networks, these computer systems inspired by our own brains. So things like the large language models that we are all talking about now and that are the basis for machine learning. And then finally, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, again, really focused on AI, but also about proteins. So this went to David Baker in the University of Washington and Demis Hassabis and John Jumper, who come from Google in DeepMind. And we've talked about this work on the program. This is all about using AI to predict the structure of proteins, but also using AI to create new kinds of proteins. And this is work that has really transformed how we might think about developing drugs in the future. And they were awarded the prize in chemistry for their work in, you know, how you could create new types of proteins from scratch, but also understand very complex protein folding. And I think we talked about it earlier this year, the AlphaFold 2 program, which came from Google DeepMind, really can predict the structure of any protein in nature. And that's been a huge breakthrough this year.
Very, very cool. And it'd be interesting to see whether or not they take the Nobel Prize off Geoffrey Hinton in years to come when we see how the whole AI thing rolls out. But our second story, Phil, has to do with stitches.
Yes, and most of us have had stitches at some stage for one reason or another. But I have some good news, because you might never look at them in the same way again, because scientists in China have developed a brand new type of suture that can do kind of more than just hold the wound together. They're calling them super sutures that actually help speed up healing and reduce the risk of infection. And they do this by an electrical shock therapy, which, although you don't need to strap batteries to yourself, but it's really quite interesting. So breaking it down, the research led by Dr. Shenji Hu and his team at Dongyu University have brought to us an electrical stimulation suture. So unlike regular stitches, they've got some kind of tech behind them. So when you move, whether you're walking, flexing a muscle, or avoiding a, you know, bumping your elbow with something, the suture generates a tiny electrical charge. And this stimulation has shown in research that can actually help wounds heal faster. Now, what they're using is something called the triboelectric effect, which we probably kind of commonly know as, you know, as electrical charge transfer between two objects when they slide across each other. So if you think of like how static electricity is generated, so that's the same kind of idea. So the idea is that when these sutures are kind of pulled or strained, that this new suture is thriving on that because it's creating electricity. It's helping to work on the how wounds heal, but it's also acting in terms of infection. So it's been tested on rats. The researchers have found that the research has promoted faster wound healing, reduced bacterial growth, which are really crucial. And they really think the other factor about this, which Doctor Who's team have done, is that not only are they new, improved, and all this cool tech, they should be similar in cost to standard absorbable sutures that you get today.
Wait, does there need to be some sort of external power to this, or some sort of mini battery, or does it sort of absorb the electricity from like a kinetic watch or those things?
Not exactly as a kinetic watch, because that is actually something that's moving in between a coil. But these generate electrical current as the strain or the stress. So as it's moved or pulled across each other, so you've got two materials rubbing across each other, essentially generating static, this triboelectric effect, and that's where the power is coming from. The other great thing about this is they're biodegradable, so you don't even have to have them pulled out. So these are a massive step in the right direction.
Fab. Ruth, our third story has to do with something we're all very familiar with, our shower head, and it being a sort of a destination for exotic creatures.
Yeah, I know, who knew that your bathroom was the most ecologically diverse place you visited over the last couple of weeks? This is research from Northwestern University, and it is looking at what is living on our shower heads and what is living on our toothbrushes. And it's the second study from this group. The first one was called Operation Putty Mouth, when they sequenced all of the different kinds of bacteria that were living on our toothbrushes and our shower heads. And this follow-up study, they are now looking at the viruses that are living there. And what they found was pretty incredible. They found 600 different types of viruses across these different toothbrush and shower head samples, many of which had never been seen before. And interestingly, they found very little overlap between different samples. So shower heads had a different kind of ecosystem to the toothbrushes. But even when you compare two different shower heads, they had quite different ranges of viruses. So this was pretty unexpected. The other thing that's interesting is that most of the viruses that they found are bacteriophages or phages. And these are viruses which specifically infect and target specific bacteria. So, I mean, the good news is they pose no threat to humans. And one of the types of phages that they found are called a mycobacteriophage. And what they do is specifically infect mycobacteria. And people might have heard of those type of bacteria because they're responsible for diseases like tuberculosis, like TB and leprosy. So there's a very finely balanced ecosystem on these surfaces in our bathrooms.
Okay. I mean, I've always known that there are bacteria in our bathrooms, but is it surprising that there are this many viruses? Is this a normal place to be looking for viruses in the first place?
I mean, I think it is quite surprising. And maybe when you think about, as you say, we all know that we can get bacteria. We have, like, the bathroom tends to be a place that's moist, and that is where bacteria can often grow. But what's interesting is that maybe these viruses are actually keeping the microbial communities in check. So that could be quite interesting. And what the team are saying is, you know, it makes you think about if you use kind of maybe excessive cleaning or, you know, extreme hygiene measures, you know, where you use disinfectants that are literally wiping out everything on your surface, you could actually be promoting more harmful microbes growing on your surfaces. Because a bit like any kind of ecosystem that we think about, you know, a rainforest or a peat bog, that in fact there's a whole series of different organisms living there, and each one is preventing any other one getting out of check. So what they recommend is maybe we shouldn't be wiping out all the microbes in our bathroom. We should use more gentle cleaners like vinegars and bicarbonate of soda, but also that it is a good idea to think about changing your toothbrush and shower head regularly enough.
Shower head as well. I mean, certainly toothbrush. I know. I mean, I never touched a shower head, so I don't know. Like it's suspended in the wall. I'm actually afraid now to go anywhere near it. Phil, our final story is equally icky, but at least it's separated from us by many, many years. A giant bug has been discovered. What exactly is this story?
Yeah, prehistorically icky, and a story. Yeah, kind of making your skin crawl. The bug that we're talking about. Like it's hard to fathom. 9 feet long, dozens of legs. This isn't kind of your ordinary creepy crawly. This is Arthropleura, the largest bug that has ever roamed the earth. And scientists recently have given us a proper mugshot, or should I say bugshot, of this ancient giant. And they had been previously missing the head. So originally they had been looking for this Arthropleura, which is a carboniferous Permian arthropod renowned from its kind of record-breaking gigantism. So they hadn't found the head before because this creature would have molted, kind of like as you would have had a snake shedding its skin. So it squirmed out through its head. So it's always left behind its skin, so we never got to see it. But what scientist Michael Leherter from University Claude Bernard in Lyon, they found fossils of juvenile versions of this giant bug, complete with the head. So the idea of what they've done with this is they've done CT scans of this, and they've seen, and they thought it would be horrific looking. And they've actually said it kind of looks kind of cute. Their definition of cute might be a little bit different. It's a round, bulbous head with two bell-shaped antennae with kind of crab-like egg eyes at the end of it and a surprisingly small mouth. So it's perfectly suited for kind of grinding up leaves and bark and not exactly the stuff of nightmares, you might say, but still pretty gross. The other thing is, was it a centipede or millipede, which is this kind of one of the kind of the big questions. It's kind of both. It has the body of a millipede, but the head of a centipede. So it's kind of a mashup of terrifying proportions. They've been studying, paleontologists have been studying fragments of this for years. Originally found like in the 1800s, 9 feet long, but finally they have found a head to attach to the bug that never skipped leg day.
Absolutely something that I'm very grateful does not exist today, but amazing to think of the size of some of these animals back in the day. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Phil Smith, Science Guy, thanks so much for joining us. In 1928, Alexander Fleming returned to his lab in St. Mary's Hospital, London, following a holiday to find mold growing in one of his petri dishes because he left the window open. The dish had contained staph bacteria, but surprisingly, the mold seemed to be preventing bacteria from growing around it. Fleming had unwittingly discovered penicillin and changed the course of medicine. Nowadays, drug discovery tends to happen in a more controlled and circumscribed way, but that doesn't mean it's straightforward. Dr. William Prow is former Chief Development Officer for Pfizer and Head of Research at Roche and author of Breakthrough, The Quest for Life-Changing Medicine. He joined me now. Welcome to the program, William. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for having me.
We hear a lot about, you know, pharma, big pharma, and a lot of the stories are often quite negative or tinged with one slant or another. But it can't be denied that we are hugely indebted to pharmaceutical companies for a range of really life saving medicines. This is something that you talk about in the book and the discovery of different medicines. Which drugs did you cover and why?
Yeah, so I wrote Breakthrough, The Quest for Life-Changing Medicines, to highlight the innovation that's going on every day in drug discovery, not only over a period of, you know, years, but actually over decades. And it's really to highlight the innovation that's going on across multiple areas, in from scientists to doctors to advocates to many people involved. So the molecules that I cover range from molecules for spinal muscular atrophy, which is a rare disease, called risdiplam, osimertinib for lung cancer, paracetamol, alpelisib, which is a medicine for breast cancer, emicizumab, a medicine for hemophilia, a medicine called CTX001 for sickle cell, which is a gene editing therapy, which is a totally new technology, nirmatrelvir, ritonavir for COVID, and lenacapavir for AIDS. So I use the generic names, they're very complicated, but yeah. It ranges across a variety of diseases and really highlights the kind of innovation that's happening every day across multiple fields of science.
Indulge this question before we start talking about the drugs. Why are most drugs ending in inab or inib, avir or plam? Why are they named that way?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So basically, the World Health Organization has a process for naming medicines.
Oh.
And there is a whole nomenclature that everyone in the industry has to follow.
Oh, really? You don't get to choose the name?
No, you can try to choose the name, but particular classes of drugs always have the same last three or four letters. The beginning may be novel, and you may get to choose a little bit, but actually somebody... in the organization actually finally decides. And the main issue is they don't want to have confusion in society.
What? Well, objective achieved.
Meaning they don't want to have one medicine sound like another medicine.
Right.
So that people
okay.
Confused.
Because I would have chosen, if I had a medicine that tackled cancer, I'd call it Cancer Blaster. You know, that's a great name for a drug.
Yeah.
But it's just not going to get past legislation, it sounds like. Okay. So let's actually have a sensible conversation now. So paracetamol has a really interesting story behind it because it's one of those drugs that lots of us take for pain relief and yet don't really know anything about its discovery.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fascinating story. Discovery is a long and winding story, and there were a lot of accidental discoveries. And actually, there was even an erroneous conclusion that prevented it from being developed for about 50 years.
Huh.
So it's a very interesting story. And it was discovered by accident, basically. Basically, back in 1886, there were a couple physicians in Strasbourg, Paul Hepp and Arnold Kahn. And they were assigned to treat a patient with intestinal worms. And at that time, they prescribed what was the standard treatment of the day, something called naphthalene. I think many of us are probably familiar with naphthalene because that's the smell from mothballs that you put in your closet to get rid of moths. Anyway, the patient took the prescription to the local pharmacy, and then he started the treatment, and it didn't work. The worms weren't eliminated, but he did have a fever. And he unexpectedly had resolution of that fever after he started the treatment. So the two doctors were amazed because there was no medicine to treat fever at the time. And they went back to the pharmacist, and then the pharmacist looked in his records and realized he'd actually dispensed the wrong medicine. So instead of giving naphthalene, he'd given another medicine called acetanilide, which is a coal tar derivative.
What was that supposed to be for?
That's a good question. Actually, I don't know exactly why he had acetanilide in his pharmacy stocks, but that's what he ended up giving. And as a doctor, I can only imagine, you know, if my pharmacist gave the wrong medicine to my patient, I'd be mortified.
There's a lot of things that they did in medicine back then that would mortify you for sure.
I mean, it wasn't as regulated. But anyway, the two physicians, Kahn and Hepp, they realized that they might be onto something.
Hmm.
And so they did some additional studies in animals, and then they treated like a handful of patients. And it turned out that it actually was a medicine that could stop fever and also help with pain. And so they realized that, and they actually even said, a lucky accident dropped the medicine into our hands. And it's a great example of, you know, just serendipity and taking advantage of unexpected observations. So Paul Hepp's brother, he worked at a chemical company. And then the chemical company ran some of their own studies, and then they ended up deciding to market that medicine, and that medicine became antifebrin. But that's only the beginning of the story. Antifebrin became a wonder drug at the time, but it often caused blue skin, which is due to something called cyanosis, and basically it was causing oxygen not to bind to hemoglobin as well. You know, hemoglobin is the protein in your red blood cells that carries oxygen. But because it was the only, medicine at the time that was working, for both pain and fever, and there was no regulation at the time, it remained on the market. And then at the same time, Bayer was making, coal tar derivatives for dyes and clothing. Actually, a lot of our medicines at that time came originally from the chemicals that were used to make dyes for clothing.
No way.
Now, the issue with phenacetin, that also caused cyanosis, but again, it wasn't highly regulated. Yeah, basically the two medicines that were approved, one from that company and then from Bayer, both of them had chemical side products that were paracetamol. But there was a physician in 1893 that was invited by Bayer, and he was a very renowned physician, and he studied that molecule, and he said it was toxic. And it turned out that he based his studies on a false, you know, possibly contaminated sample. But because because he was so well-renowned, people thought that that molecule was toxic, and so there was no further development of paracetamol for about 50 years.
Wow. And so a sort of good circumstances and bad circumstances eventually precipitate this this drug, paracetamol. So then how did it end up coming back into use?
Yeah, so basically then by the 1940s, there were a lot of side effect patients with side effects from both the two medicines, antifebrin and phenacetin. And so actually the New York City Health Department decided to study why these patients were having complications. And the long story short is they found the reason why, which was there was a toxic chemical being broken down in humans when they took that those two medicines. But they also found that paracetamol was one of the breakdown products of both of those medicines. And then they showed that paracetamol actually had the same effect as those two medicines for pain and fever, but none of the side effects. And then basically McNeil Laboratories, which was a small R&D company based in Philadelphia, they decided to develop paracetamol. And only in the 1950s then was paracetamol eventually approved.
You know, I had no idea that there's such a complicated route for a molecule discovery to go through so many different twists and turns. I thought you discovered a molecule and then, there might have been an alternative that was built on it. If you look at the drugs that one of the other drugs you talk about in the work, which you worked on, osimertinib, going off 50 different versions of the drug, or did this particular drug, was it something that it was discovered pretty much straight away it had efficacy? Can you tell me the story of that drug?
Yeah, so osimertinib, actually, the original observations in science go back to the 1950s. I'm going to start sort of early, where people didn't even know how cancer cells grew and why cancers were developing in the first place. But there were some scientists, including a woman, Rita Levi-Montalcini, and Stanley Cohen, who were just asking the simple question, why do cells grow? Mm. And so they were just trying to figure out how do cells grow. And the long story short is they discovered that there were these factors in the blood called growth factors that could actually stimulate cells to grow. And then they said, if there's factors in the blood that stimulate cells to grow, then how do the cells know that those factors are there? And then they eventually said, there must be receptors or stuff on the surface of the cells to detect those growth factors. And then other scientists were able to show, there are these receptors. Now, why am I telling you this? Because then those receptors turned out to be involved in cancer. And you can imagine, if you have a receptor that's trying to tell the cell to grow and that it's telling it to grow all the time, that you would eventually have a cancer growing instead of a normal situation.
What is it like working on a drug like osimertinib? And this is a drug for lung cancer, right?
Right.
This is hugely devastating disease for many people, poor outcomes for a lot of patients. When you start looking at this and going, hang on a second, this is pretty big. What is that like working in AstraZeneca, I think it was at the time?
Yeah, I mean, osimertinib is developed by AstraZeneca. And as you mentioned, lung cancer is the leading cause of death worldwide, unfortunately. Most of it's related to a history of smoking. But actually, it turns out about 10 to 20% of patients actually never smoked cigarettes or smoked less than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime. Hmm. We call those they smoked a few in college or something like that. It is a growing population, surprisingly. And it turns out osimertinib works particularly well in patients who had a history of never smoking but have lung cancer. And it's because they have a particular mutation in the tumor cell that makes them more sensitive to osimertinib. I mean, it's amazing once you develop a molecule that can have a benefit for lots of patients. That's one of the reasons that I personally decided to do drug development full time. If you can develop a medicine that really helps hundreds of thousands or even millions of patients worldwide, it's really fulfilling. And you know that, you know, potentially you had a big impact on changing patients' lives.
What about how we come across and produce new medicines and new molecules now? Is it a much less happenstance sort of way? Is it very methodical going through lots of different molecules that we have in our, you know, in our labs and just throwing the kitchen sink and seeing what sticks? How do we develop new medicines?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, we like to think that it's a very logical, orderly process, and that we know exactly what we're doing, you know, when we set out to make a new medicine. But many times, and that's what's highlighted in the book, it requires, you know, really learning by doing. You have one hypothesis and one idea, but it turns out not to be right in humans, or you make one molecule and it looks great in preclinical models, but then once you put it into humans, it might have unanticipated side effects. So there's a lot of trial and error. And then, as I also tried to highlight, there's a lot of serendipity involved. So sometimes you get an unexpected result, but it's those who really can understand, hey, why did I get that weird result? And how do I use that to, you know, make further advances? Those are the ones who can really innovate and make progress. It's a lot of innovation. It's forging new territory. So it's not a straightforward process, or it's not as straightforward as people might think.
What about the combination of AI and the drugs that we already have? Are we likely to see a precipitation of a huge amount of market-ready drugs for conditions that that these drugs weren't initially prescribed for? Because there's a lot of work in that, right? Looking at the molecules that we've already approved, because it takes so long to get something approved, and seeing if they might be candidates for other conditions and diseases?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think artificial intelligence is going to accelerate everything that we're doing in life, including in drug development. It's not going to find everything, but certainly I think what you're talking about is repurposing molecules. Hmm. And there have been studies using AI and other methods to repurpose, meaning you find a medicine might be already approved, but it wasn't approved in a particular disease. And some insights from AI and other methods might suggest that, you know, the medicine might be working in this particular disease. I think what's really exciting is I call this the biological century. We've really had massive advances in science and technology in understanding clinical diseases, and the pace of drug discovery is accelerating. So I think the future is bright in terms of finding solutions for diseases for which we don't have any treatments yet.
Look, you are in a rather unique position in that you have experience of being a research scientist and, of course, being in management of a major drug company. So I'm going to ask you this question. When you discover a drug that, you know, cures, or at least cures for some people, lung cancer, do you get like a bonus for that? Do you get a cut of the profits, or is that just your job? Because we hear all the time about how much money these pharma companies make. Do you get like made up for life as a result of a discovery like that, or how does it work?
That's a great question. Usually the scientists who are working on the molecules, they file patents, and then the company actually derives the profits from those. The scientists don't actually get very much from those, particularly the ones inside the companies. But it also depends on which company you're in and what the policies are. I understand the cost of drugs is very high, and has can be hugely impactful on patients. However, also the drug development process really does take a long time, and I tried to highlight that in the book, where even one of the companies with a breast cancer medicine actually took four different molecules into the clinic because all three previously failed, and it was only the fourth one that was successful. So, you know, what's approved is the successful one. You don't see all the failures behind that. Hmm. Somebody has to also pay for the cost of all the failures.
Sure, yeah. But it would be really nice to know. I mean, I would like to know that the person who came up with you know, the HIV drug that makes HIV livable for people, which is incredible. You know, I'd love to think that those people got, you know, a quarter of the bonus that the CEO at the top did. You know, that would be some good PR, I think, to get the scientists a bit of, you know, to reward them for the work that they do. But I don't know.
I think there are a lot of unsung heroes, and that's what I also tried to highlight in the book. There are all these people for which they're, you know, working hard every day, really working on the science and making these breakthroughs, and nobody knows who they are, and nobody knows who, you know, what kind of effort they've put in.
Mm. You can read about those in the book. It's called Breakthrough, The Quest for Life-Changing Medicines. Dr. William Powell, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot.
And that's it on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo De Silva on sound.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.